Somewhat, as long as I've got material to work with.
I'm recording on this end as well.
Brilliant.
All right. Hello, everybody. And today we have Eric Francis Coppolino in the house, distinguished along several trajectories and on the menu. A few different things, but we're going to lead with the question of digital conditions and how they ramify for spiritual considerations broadly framed. The problems of the digital, that's something I've discussed on this channel at a certain length, and Eric has been concerned with it as well, particularly in connection with its implications for events of recent years. But I don't want to prattle on too long. I want to sort of turn it over to Eric and ask how he would like to sort of open the conversation.
Well, first of all, by saying thanks for having me. I love broadcasting in new venues and meeting new presenters, and thanks for being open to my ideas.
I mean, well, really, I was first introduced to you through the interview you did with Sam Bailey, where you talked about 1969 and Woodstock, and the Hong Kong flu was raging, and all sorts of things were going on in 1969. And an upper respiratory infection did not slow the world down as a consequence. So what was the differential between that interval and our own? And there's more than one, but the crucial one is the extent of digital conditioning, which in a sense was already on the way even in 1969, but nothing like I believe anyone could have really anticipated. Well, almost anybody could have really anticipated. Some people like McLuhan, of whom you're a fan. There's some other sort of periphery critics. I'm a big fan of Gunther Anders, who was a critic of broadcast media, but what happens with digital seems to take it to another level.
Yeah.
How does it connect, though, with the spiritual? And you could say it's a point of interface is its implications for our own mind.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking personally, when I interface with digital media, the phone is often sort of the parade example because we almost all have one, but it's not merely the phone. I sort of phenomenologically experience a sense of being fractured, fragmented, not quite unified as a subjectivity. There's a centrifugal effect, I think, from engaging with that space, especially at a certain length. And also, what it does is it creates a counter world or a world outside of that which we concretely experience with our own bodies.
Mm-hmm.
I think these are two points of entry. How would you like to proceed from there?
Well, spiritual is existential. It's our sense of who we are, our sense of connection to ourselves, to some greater cosmos, and to one another. So spiritual is pretty much everything, unless you're obsessed with the thought system of guilt and fear, which is still a spiritual condition. The things you describe, in particular, the world apart, I'm not sure how you said it, but the counter world, I think, as well as the ungrounded, intangible world of digital versus the actual, you know, waking life, physical consciousness. We need to get around the world that we actually do live in. Is also one of the central circumstances, because what happens is that the properties of one world bleed over into the other, And digital has an effect. All media environments have an effect on everything. So that's the essence of McLuhan's theory, that the medium is the message. And what he's saying is that the environment is what drives us. And this is not a nature versus nurture debate. You just look around and you see that as new environments are pushed on humanity, humanity keeps changing. And there's very few people who are looking ahead, if any, and there's very few people who are looking back and saying, what really did this? The example you started with, I think Woodstock is really one of the perfect examples to describe the before and after world. It came as quite a surprise to me when my guitar tech down in the city mentioned that the Hong Kong flu is going on at least as a media event at full strength at the time of the Woodstock Festival and the year before. And yet, when you look at the photos, you'll see the people are comfortable around one another. They're not afraid of getting sick. They're sitting essentially, they're basically soaking in a cow pasture. They're basically part of the ground. Their bodies are soaked in mud and they're hanging out there and having a good time. If you look at their comportment toward one another, they're all kind of leaning on one another. And the guys are hanging out too. The guys are piled up like we expect girls to be today. And there's no homophobia. There's just guys hanging out. And when you then skip ahead 51 years to 2020 and you see these pictures of people sitting in these nice, tidy creases drawn in the park in circles, and this person's there with her dog and her computer, and this couple is there with their blanket with their dog, and then this guy sitting in that one, and they're all 20 feet apart, and you contemplate what's changed in 51 years. I think the United States is in many ways the same culture except for one thing, which is it's now a digital culture. There are still most of the same problems exist. More people are struggling. Things are more expensive. That's all true. That, too, is a probable consequence of digital. But the thing that really changed is that it was a digital world in 2020 and today, and it was not a digital world in 1969. It was an analog world. It was still an electrical world. It was still a world driven by television. That was the main media driver of its time. Digital would not really start to percolate in for a little while. TV was driving the war protests and many other things. And it is a sad state of affairs to see that people have gone from trusting one another in and trusting one another's presence to absolutely not trusting one another or their presence in just the space of 50 years.
You could almost even compress that timeline, because I don't think it started to get.
Yeah.
Well, I think in the late 80s is when things really started to pivot. Speaking personally, while the birth of the internet obviously catalyzes, there are other examples of difference as well, besides for Woodstock, like you mentioned, the television protests, the television driving the protests, the Vietnam, and now we have wars, but people's relationships with wars are so different politically. War is a spectacle in a way. People are removed from the Ukraine, except it's something to talk about at cocktail parties or whatever the conflict du jour happens to be. And there's this thing about how the digital creates this impression of the world. Gunther Anders talks about this. Before broadcast media and the digital, the world is something into which you go out, and it's something which pushes back, and there's a relationship. But with broadcast media and subsequently with the digital and internet, the Twitterverse, what happens is the world becomes just a source of commodity. It becomes something to bring into your life or your home as something to consume. And so this changes the subject in a dramatic way. It induces a kind of passivity, and it makes the subject more susceptible to manipulation, coercion, so on and so forth. And these are all, so spirituality, as you said, is also existential. And it connects, I think, intimately to the issue of freedom, like a deep, in a deep way. And of course, freedom is something upon which one needs to reflect. It's not just something which is the function of caprice, like I can do whatever I want to do. That's a very limited sense of what freedom is. Freedom is rather something that I believe emerges from our relationship with the world and with each other. But for that relationship to be real, you have to be engaged. And if you're induced to constant passivity, that is inimical to the engagement, which is the foundation of our freedom and also actually, you know, real love. Like, that's the thing, is it interferes with our capacity to love one another by virtue of the illusions that it sort of conjures.
Yeah, the foundation of love is trust. You almost don't need the word love. All you need is trust and affection. Because love gets contaminated by very many viewpoints. Trust is the thing really that is damaged, particularly in an environment where it almost seems as if 99% of what comes through is some kind of a scam. You know, the free piano scam, or the all the whatever the phishing scheme du jour is. And that is a very difficult environment to live in. And the problem is that it's our tools that are doing this, and humans fashion their tools, and then their tools fashion them. And so we're being fashioned by this digital tool to be something that is untrusted, untrustworthy, fragmented, and virtual. That's not tangible. So that's a real problem, and you can see the effect of that problem. For example, in looking at what actually happened in 2020, which is that people were sufficiently destabilized by digital technology that they were able to be terrorized by what amounted to an in silico AI-generated concept of a virus, and a lot of reports about it, and they took to it. They believed it. They made it the hero. They made it COVID. SARS-CoV-2 was not the villain. SARS-CoV-2 was the hero of 2020, because it drove the story like a protagonist, and pretty much everyone kowtowed to it and wrapped their arms around it, even to their own detriment. That's the result of digital conditioning. There were other problems with television conditioning, and there were other problems with radio conditioning, but they are really starting to look minor in comparison to where we are going, with not only a world create an imaginary world created by TV producers, right? That's one of the memes of television, the message of the medium of television. Everything is a contrived and constructed story. But in digital, nothing is real, basically. And if it's real, it's only real as long as the internet connection holds up, and then suddenly it's gone.
The trust issue, I think, is that's something, because what we have accompanying the digital is an expansion of digital bureaucratization. And this shows up in an obvious way with things like digital IDs and expanded surveillance and so on and so forth. And I'm really just noting that to buttress your point, that the digital undermines are I actually think that there's actually, for most people, there is a desire, an instinct, a movement toward trust naturally. Sometimes that can be tragically inhibited by the conditions of one's early life, but that's, in a way, it's weirdly encouraging because all these mechanisms have to be set in place and have to be operated constantly to renew the friction toward our drive to trust one another. So it's actually, I think, encouraging that human beings still want to embrace each other despite all of the barriers to the full expressions of those trusts. That being said, it's not something about which I'm all rainbows and unicorns, because the conditioning and the friction and so forth has been quite effective. And another thing which has been effective is creating a great deal of just sort of like dropping out, where people just have no sense of connection with their political realities. And I mean that even on a local level, there's a sense of alienation from one's own community that follows from this, and in a very concrete. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that connection.
Yeah, I think the situation may be a bit worse than you're saying. I think that the tropism toward trust is certainly a real thing, and partly it's real because people know we do know that we need one another. But I think that when we start excluding one another categorically, when we went through this drama of a bifurcated society, the vaccinated are allowed in and the unvaccinated are not allowed in, and it was not just Madison Square Garden. A lot of people were running their homes like this and excluding their mother or their children or a sister from a holiday meal because they didn't have enough booster shots, or they didn't want to get any injections at all. That is something that is now temporarily latent, but it is an injury that is ready to be injured again. And we all know from injuries that, you know, once you hurt your knee, you're likely to hurt it again. And so the whole thing with a knee or shoulder injury or something is to not re-injure it, because the re-injuries get successively worse, and particularly if they're not treated properly and recovered from properly. And we've made no effort to recover consciously from this COVID operation that was launched on us. And furthermore, one of the most frightening things that's happening in this digital environment is that the most untrustworthy presenters are the wealthiest and the most influential among them. And this is very frightening. And the presidential candidacy of Robert F. Kennedy is an example of this. He has he has kettled most of the so-called, I call it the health truthiness movement, together in around a fundamental lie, a lie which he will not even question publicly and makes many excuses for not doing so. And so we are now in another spiral where Fauci has been replaced by Pete McCullough, Robert Malone, Robert F. Kennedy, Peter Bregan, and all of these people who have now picked up the narrative. They've picked up the torch, and they are running with it, and they've got a lot of people following them. And so there's a new bifurcation going on, only we've gotten rid of the kitsch, not particularly pleasant to look at face of Anthony Fauci in that voice. And now it's been replaced by people who we venerate as our friends and heroes when they are demonstrably lying. In the segment right before this one, I'm taking apart Pete McCullough and a supposed journalist named Seth Holehouse. I would change my name if my name was Holehouse, but anyway, Seth Holehouse. It is just It is endless lies with a little bit of limited hangout, a little bit of throwing lip service to freedom, your freedoms. Well, what's that mean? And I've got some background noise going on too. I think it's the ice cream factory across the street from my house. So I'm going to mute while you're speaking.
Well, just a few different things there. One, and you could call it you could put it as an issue of history, even though we're talking about just literally the last 4 years, this cultural tendency toward amnesia, right? Where most people, you would think that nothing had happened. Or, I mean, that's a slight exaggeration, but not really. You go out and about, and people, and it's very tempting to just be relieved, like, oh, thank God, you know, not everyone has a diaper on their face or whatever, you know. But there was an enormous violence perpetrated against people, an enormous violence, the confinement, the bizarre behavior recommendations, the mRNA interventions, the list goes on and on and
they're
on.
They're hurting people to the vaccine centers. Hurting them to the vaccine centers.
And there's no, in my view, sufficient acknowledgement of what a bizarre and horrific thing or set of things were unfolding over these past few years, right? And you even see it that in certain media outlets, it's called pandemic revisionism, where there's an attempt to actively reframe what occurred by the mainstream media. So, it wasn't so bad, you know, we were scared and maybe mistakes were made. It's like, that is not what transpired. There was active structural deception. Yes, there were sincere people who were deceived and made part of what happened, but that is insufficient to dismiss or simply, you know, forgive and forget. And this is in micro is part of a broader, I think it's an American thing, but it's not just an American thing, to just allow the past to fall away and then live merely in this day and this day alone, which is problematic. It's a kind of corruption of the imperative to be present, right? It's a corruption because it's if you're really fully present, then the past is there as well to be incorporated into your future. So I just really want to underline the significance of acknowledging that grievous traumas were induced in these past few years in a way that is not being acknowledged. And then to your second related point, that now you have people, like I've had many people say, oh, I'm sure you're going to, because they're aware of my pretty radical position on the COVID questions. They're like, oh, I'm sure you're going to vote for RFK Jr. And the thing is, what you have is this allergy to, I will say, there's an allergy to radical and rigorous analysis. Because if you're truly radical, and you're going to drive yourself to the root of the phenomenon and really have the courage to look at it in its full truth, which sometimes is ugly and inconvenient and often resists tidy formulation. And that's not what's going on with RFK Jr. Okay. No. Who's really kind of a bizarre figure, because I can't just throw the baby out with the bathwater and say that he's just like the worst thing than sliced bread, right? Like if you ask me to choose between RFK Jr. and a criminal and a horrific being like Anthony Fauci, whose crimes go all the way back to what happened with AIDS in the 80s. I mean, it's amazing that that was so effectively suppressed. It didn't come up at all in the what happened in recent years. Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to take RFK Jr. But it's a Sophie's. It's a Sophie's choice, right? It's a false choice.
Yes.
Because it's not A or B. We can do better than A or B, right? So sort of like Malone and so forth, right? It's not that they're the worst thing in the world, right? But if you really are committed to the truth, then you're going to proceed to a space beyond where they are situating themselves. What characterizes those figures is they're all making compromises in my view. They're making compromises in their narratives as a concession to what they consider to be political reality, realpolitik, right? In fact, that's actually a relatively generous reading, but that's the reading I'm going to apply for the sake of a conversation. You know, like, so you think you can't really suggest to people that viruses don't exist, because that's just going to put you outside of the conversation. And then what I would say, as long as I'm indulging myself here, is, have you ever heard of a phlogiston? Do you know where the phlogiston is?
No, what is it?
Well, before they understood how combustion worked, which is somewhere in the middle 19th century, it was hypothesized that there was a subatomic particle known as the phlogiston. Eventually, they figured out how combustion worked, and people realized that that was a scientifically void hypothesis, which was not altogether implausible, but which was ultimately bankrupt. Nobody knows what a phlogiston is anymore, but if you're in like 1839 in a laboratory in Oxford, it's going to be completely respectable to talk about the role of the phlogiston in combustion processes, right? You know, or you can look at the historical treatment of the ether, and the notion that there has to be some sort of mediating substance that has fallen out of favor. Or, you know, so there's all kinds of the theory of humors, for example, right? Medieval humors and what have you. So you can look at all these precedents in terms of historical positions that were contemporaneously considered scientific and beyond impeachment, and fast forward a few decades or centuries, and now people laugh at them. They laugh at them, right? So that's what I say. It's like, look, the concept is void. The concept is void. I actually even think the concept is incoherent.
Which concept?
The concept of the virus, right? But we don't have to become detained by that. It's just that it's in the background, and so it's important to mention.
It's a placeholder. It's a placeholder for an unknown, like the humors, which are descriptive. The humors are descriptive, right? There is such a thing as a phlegmatic person. So we can't not have, we can't throw away their descriptive property, but the problem with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is not only that he asserts that there is a virus. The problem, in my view, with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is that he asserts himself as being wholly truthful. If you look at any one of these emails he sends out, he's got his hand on the Bible at all times saying, I'm telling the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God, over and over again. He opens his mouth. I'm Robert F. Kennedy Jr. We're all good people. We don't leak information to the Nazis from the embassy in London. We don't run bootlegging operations during Prohibition. We're good. We're not gangsters. We're good people. When, in fact, he suppresses the entire discussion of the virus. This, in my view, is the real problem, that he is presenting himself as one thing in front of the curtain, and behind the curtain, he is a whole other thing, presents himself as an expert on understanding scientific papers and being a great attorney. And then in the background, he says, well, I'm not an expert. I defer to the experts. his, I don't know if you're familiar with, I mean, while we're on the topic of Robert F. Kennedy, his actual position on the virus issue. I wrote a Substack earlier this year called "Why Is Robert F. Kennedy Running from the Missing Virus Problem?"
Yes, I remember that piece.
Yeah, and basically what he says is that you guys, meaning me and Christine Massey, Tom Cowan, Alex Zeck, Michael Stone, the Baileys, Dr. Kaufman, Dr. Cowan, you guys can take all the beatings and the floggings, and then when you've established the issue as being legitimate, I'll come in and steal the issue and take credit for it. I don't think that's ever going to happen, but that's basically what he said. What he's doing now is, I think, a complete contrivance. It's constructed. It is psychologically managed to gather what remains of a health freedom movement or COVID truth movement into a deeper version of the lie, and just hypnotize them out of being able to take any action whatsoever or ask any real questions. Now it's all about rallying around the flagpole of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. People who might have taken a risk in the past are now content to sell buttons at a rally for $5, and they think that they're saving the world. This is the problem with Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
It connects to a broader problem with movements like the health freedom movement, where what we're looking at, and I think this also connects to the problem of how we situate actual science in the public discourse, where I would say maybe something like 15% of what is presented as science in mainstream public discourse can actually pass muster. I think the vast majority of it is diluted efforts of popularization that actually undermine what constitutes substantial scientific research, and more problematically, create a narrative that can be invoked to mask very dangerous political ideologies. And where this really shows up is with climate change, where there are serious ecological issues at hand, but the predominant narrative of climate change that wants to focus on one narrow point, that is carbon emission, distracts people from what would actually be entailed by arriving at actionable, effective solutions. And this distraction is important because it plays into the maintenance of the status quo. So that's why you have a company like British Petroleum framing itself as a very green company. And that's just an example, right? So, you know, you have to get at what is actual science, because when you look at how the word or the concept of science is used in popular discourse, it is almost empty of real content. It's just a magical word, like, oh, this is the science. I can't believe you're not being scientific. And no one's doing the actual work of the science, right? This all relates, because it connects to how we as a society have been captured. It actually also feeds back into sort of spiritual issues, but we can hold those in abeyance, because it occurs to me because we had talked about this the other day, and I think this is an occasion to bring it up, is the inadequacy of journalism at this moment. What is journalism? You know, what, you know, you talk about the function of the media as sort of conditioning us, and a subset of that is how the component of the media, which announces itself as some sort of bearer of truth, the fourth estate, has completely, as far as, well, all but completely, in my view, forsaken its responsibilities, right? I mean, I can actually think of Amy Goodman, who was the first person. It wasn't her line, but she quoted it, right? It's the fourth estate, not for the state. But now even she is sort of, I'm sorry to say, because I there was a time when I really respected Amy Goodman, has sort of become part of this tragic, I don't know what you want to call it, this collapse of the journalistic enterprise. As now it's merely seemingly an exponent of entertainment or propaganda.
Yeah, Amy has become all agenda driven. There's not a modicum of objectivity to what she's doing at this time. And she's basically turned advocacy journalism, which was her specialty, into propaganda. And I'm sorry to say that we are part of the same network, Pacifica Network, and she's kind of the flagship station, though different people have different opinions about her within the network. But generally, she is held as being kind of a paragon, and she was right there with all the mitigation measures and the masking and the distancing and the vaccines, and there was no difference between her, MSNBC, and Fox News. And so when suddenly the what is said to be the paragon of the alternative press is doing the same exact things and sending the same exact messages as everyone else, you know something else is going on. You know that there's something in the total environment, and she is no longer an anti-environment, person. By anti-environment, I mean going against the dominant paradigm. She's just going right along with the dominant paradigm, and it is all woke all the time, basically. And we could talk about what that is in a bit. A lot of the program, my program today, is going to be devoted to that concept. Journalism, like science, is not the truth. I think the mistake we make with both is we expect the truth from science and the truth from journalism, and not some objective attempt to describe reality in a limited way. Right? Science.
Right. Right.
Science has been run up the flagpole as the truth, but it's no such thing. All the important things in life cannot be proven by science. You can't prove anything really relevant with science. Do you love your mother? Describe my relationship with my dog. I love reading scientific studies about dogs. Most of them are so they almost come off like the study has never met a dog. The person doing the study has never actually seen the thing that it's describing. You can't have a scientific study saying that the Beatles' White Album is a fantastic record. The things that really matter to us are completely outside the realm of science, and science has been foisted on us, colonized us in a sense as a false god. Yet another false god, and then it has positioned itself as the final arbiter of all reality. And now you have even one of the more the actual more radical branches of the COVID truth movement are generally attacking science, the institution, and are kind of battling themselves into this false paradigm again by saying, just because science hasn't proven it, that it doesn't exist. It's not real. It's like, well, wait, I don't need science to tell me that I live on a spherical planet. I've studied this from every possible physical angle that I can. I understand what Mars retrograde is. It is plain to see right before your eyes in the night sky what Mars retrograde is. I don't need science to tell me that, right? I don't need science to tell me that the sun setting and the moon rising at the same time suggests that I'm in between those two objects, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think it is important to recognize that there is not a scientific study that says that SARS-CoV-2 has never been found in a human being. 217 governments admit this, that they can't find a paper anywhere in the world. But we need a lot of other things to establish this problem. And that does not tell us why people get sick in and of itself. So we need a circumspect view to have any sense of reality. Weren't you the one saying to me yesterday that you'll never even know everything that's true in a 30-mile radius from your house?
Right. I mean,
30 miles. Right. You go there every day.
It's if you like just take a time to go somewhere to which you usually go, but go by a different route.
Yes.
Like take a different, you know, just go take the long, take the scenic route, as they say.
Yeah.
You will discover something.
Yes.
Even if you go the route you usually go, if you just pay attention, I guarantee you'll notice 7 things that you never noticed before.
Yeah. This is the gift of photography for me. I went out this morning. I took my camera. I'm now the photographer for Planet Waves. That's no longer delegated. So now I go on expeditions looking for interesting things to photograph. And so now I get to stop every place that merely looks interesting and poke around for a minute and then meet whoever I might meet, ask whatever questions I might ask, study the rubble on the ground of a brickyard where I was today. There's a lot waiting for you. It's not like, you know, getting on an airplane and, you know, going to Nicaragua. That's got its own special thrill to it. But I think your point was great about you'll never know the history of that 30 miles. You'll never know all the things in that 30 miles, the people. You'll never see everything there is to see, even though you might spend most of your time in that little environment.
Yeah, I just going down any street, just go to any street, go down 3 blocks, and you look at the people who live in those 3 blocks. You will never know everything that happened with all those people.
No.
That's in 3 blocks, no. Maybe even 1 block.
No, you have your neighbors.
Right? Like, how do these people, you know, how do they pay for their house? You know, who are their uncles? Right? All that sort of thing. Right? You know, and so there's this conceit. There's this conceit of all knowing, which.
Yes.
That.
Conceit. Yes. Yes.
And it's embarrassingly easy to expose. Embarrassingly easy. Right. It's really hard on the ego. Okay. You know, to admit just how little I actually know. I, you know, so you have to sort of almost like stave off the temptation to believe, oh, I must be some kind of a fraud. No, we're all cosmically ignorant. Okay. But you're not supposed to admit that. Even though it's actually very freeing, because you're what happens when you open yourself up to the extent of your ignorance is that you're no longer manacled by certitude. Certitude actually manacles you, right? That's the part of what they drive at with the phrase Zen mind, beginner mind, right? In the mind of the expert, there's but one possibility. In that of the beginner, there are thousands, right? Millions, right? And infinite, right? Because the beginner is not oppressed by their sense of expertise.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of, you know, lost the thread there. Well, we were talking about journalism and truth and science and truth. And you know,
yeah. So the, I think the main point there that led us down the trail of like telling the story of studying the rubble in the old brickyard where I was today, which I'll share that photo with you when I process it. It's kind of cool. Is that the propaganda campaign says that science is the truth. Journalism is the truth. Then we expect it to be the truth rather than a more or less honest telling of events. Sincere for its own purposes, never free of viewpoint. And now in journalism, we have to deal with the idea of the writer's viewpoint and the publication's viewpoint. But there are ways to deal with the viewpoint. There are conventions that should be in journalism that guide you to being more circumspect, that account for things like a conflict of interest, that make a distinction between a statement of fact, a statement of belief, and a statement of opinion. And when we lose those distinctions, when we lose those sometimes a little bit loose categories, but nonetheless, I think worth keeping in mind, we end up in the kind of intellectual anarchy we are in right now. But I would point out that this anarchy is coming from the bottom up. It's not coming from the top down. Writers are tapping into the fact that the thing that readers seem to want the most is to be emotionally triggered rather than informed or enlightened. They want their buttons pushed. And you can see this in a lot of Substacks that just seem to, you know, the writer's like, push the mouse, boom. The mail blast goes out, boom. The comments come flying in. Everyone's triggered. That's the participation element of digital. And it's like, well, who cares if it's true or accurate or not? My buttons were pushed. I got what I paid for.
Well, really, the thing there too, and this connects to the digital, actually, I think, in a way, in a deep way, because the digital perspective structurally is a binary perspective. Mm-hmm. Ones and zeros.
Yes.
Now, you come into the question of the perspectival nature of not just journalism, but also science, and that inexorably there's a subjective dimension to the formation of the proposition or the narrative or what is being put forth. What is the binary in the background? The binary is either there is absolute certitude or there is complete relativism.
Bullshit.
Yeah, so it's a false binary.
Hell yeah.
But it's the binary which is culturally operative. And where the juice is in between, where you exist in the tension.
Yeah.
You exist in the tension and you have the faith to say, look, this is not the absolute truth, but is more honest, right? Honesty is the forgotten virtue. As that's a line of Nietzsche. I'm not a big Nietzsche guy, but he has some good lines, right? Honesty is a forgotten virtue. So there's the digital technologically and philosophically invites us to a binary relationship with the world on multiple levels, ontologically, epistemologically, so on and so forth. But the world, reality, our experience is not in concrete terms, it is not actually binary. There's a continuum.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then on the latter end of what you're saying, in terms of this inclination, dude, this isn't as I think deep an issue as a binary issue, but there's this propensity toward clickbait and all that. And there's always been something like that, so-called muck-breaking journalism and so forth, right? Mm-hmm. But it seems to have risen to a new level, and where people are actively pandering. There's an active pandering. Interesting, the word pandering seems to have fallen out of general circulation, even though there's an awful lot of it going on. But you can't write to pander. You can't create to pander. I mean, I suppose if you do, I mean, you can. You can do that.
You mean the appeal to it? You can't create the appeal. You can only feed the appeal.
Right. Right. I mean, well, what I mean is that if you're going to try and speak for the truth, then you can't frame the truth. What am I saying here? What I'm saying is that there's a tension between relaying a message honestly and then trying to excite your audience. If you're just trying to excite your audience, that's going to undermine your commitment to the truth of what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah. Fair enough. Right. And the thing is that the audience is being incited in a way that serves the person doing the inciting. And I think that
that's the way in which the internet, in particular, internet journalism, likes, and so forth, that sort of feeds into that very actively.
Look, in the past, it used to be special to be the paperboy. Now everyone's the editor in chief. And so there's a kind of a, you know, people who are new to this are really getting their yayas out. And some find that they're naturally very good at it. They pick up on what it takes to, you know, build a monetizable social media account in 3 months. I mean, there are people who have a knack for this, and that's a different knack than being willing to take 10 years and work on a story. I mean, that's my reality as an investigative journalist. I might have to work on something for 5 or 10 years before I know enough to say something about it, and that takes incredible patience. I'm aware that I'm kind of a unique actor in the journalism sphere right now, you know, it's funny. Anytime I break a big story, I'm accused of being a psyop. I'm like, I am the worst possible psyop. How could you look at my let's call it my portfolio of diversity of interests and who the people I hold as my heroes. But I'm regularly accused of being a psychological operation. And that shows you something of the where this information is all landing.
Well, you were sharing with me in the wake of September 11th how people became frustrated with the fact that you weren't collapsing your analysis onto, like, you had created a satirical piece, as I
About
recall,
Dick Cheney
about
admitting that
Dick
he had
Cheney.
did 9/11 after his heart transplant, because he got the heart of a 9/11 truther who mysteriously died. So they cut that guy's heart out and they gave it to Dick Cheney, and then suddenly he had to come clean about 9/11. I'll just recap this. It was the one time I had to take my phone number off the internet, because when people found out that it was a joke, they were outraged. My friend Betty Dodson, who was about 81 years old at the time, didn't talk to me for a month when she found out. And she's not, she was, she died a couple of years ago. She was not a dumbass, and she had a great sense of humor, wicked sense of humor. But she really believed that Dick Cheney had a heart transplant of a 9/11 truther. So that was interesting. That was, you know, these satires I do a fair number of them. They're all probes. I'm probing the environment to see how people are responding and where they're at. And it's it, you know, McLuhan says to do this. I didn't learn that from McLuhan. I've been doing these little pranks and punks and phony course registration forms and since I was a kid. And they tell me a lot about how people respond, how credulous or incredulous they are, what they'll believe and won't believe, how seriously they take themselves, and what they can't tell is absolutely absurd. Absurd. Something's changed.
Yes, there's the loss of irony, a sense of irony, the humor. Things are flat. It's just it's times is really kind of almost bizarre, the perspectival shifts that we've encountered. What was I? There was something else I was going to say.
Were you talking about facing the unknown? I think that's one of the most important things we can talk about, existentially, spiritually, journalistically, scientifically, is the need to be able to hold the discomfort of not knowing, and not rush to some conclusion and to stay there. Stay. It's not that bad, you know. It's not that bad. You know, you're not an idiot. If you can hold the idea that you don't know the answer to this for like a day or two, nothing's going to happen to you, except you may grow a little older and wiser at the same time. And this
That's,
applies to every aspect of life.
I mean, it was that's what it was. I was going to come at it from a different angle. I was going to come at it from the angle of patience. And as you said, you know, you're going to work on a story 5 years or 10 years. I was actually reminded of that there's a documentary a few years ago about Tommy Caldwell, the climber, and what's his partner's name? It'll come to me in a second. It's called, I can't remember the name of the documentary, but he climbed, he and his friend, and it, and of course it was like, when they actually did it, they got a lot of press. They were in the New York Times and
what
so
did they
on.
Climb? Do you remember?
They climbed the big wall at Yosemite.
Okay. El Capitan?
It wasn't El Capitan, was it? It was another face of Yosemite. He's climbed, he's like the Yosemite guy. He's climbed everything in Yosemite.
And they did a free climb.
They did a free climb. Well, it was free, so not Alexander Hunold, he's another guy. But anyway, he worked on this project with his friend. He and his friend worked on this project for 10 years. Okay.
To climb this.
They climbed this continually from base to summit because no one had ever done it, because it's an enormous climb, right? To do that in that particular fashion. You really have to, and there were segments of the route that no one had ever conquered. So you had to find the beta, and you know, I'll find it to you and send it to you, because it's a great documentary for multiple reasons. One is that it shows the power of friendship between these two guys who really didn't know each other until Tommy Caldwell decided, okay, I'm going to do this, but I need a partner. It's a two-person job. This other guy. So there's the power of friendship, but then there's the power of persistence to work on something like this. You're not getting paid, okay? You're not getting press. It's just you, this other dude, and a wall for 10 years, okay? Or maybe it was 9 years or something like that, okay? That is incredibly countercultural. That is countercultural. All right. And then when they got to the point when they did it, and they did do it, phenomenal. You know, they got a lot of press then. It was in the New York Times.
Yeah,
and,
saving it all up.
Right. And they came out there, and all the, you know, they came out, and the New York Times is really obnoxious, and they're halfway up, and Tommy Caldwell suddenly accidentally lost his phone because he got tired of dealing with the press. It's like, come on. But anyway, I'll try and send that link to you. But the main point of the story is, like, you're not, it's just that project that you're going to work on something for 10 years. It's countercultural.
Yeah.
When you think about it, cathedrals were built over generations.
Yeah.
The notion of a generational project seems very difficult to get off the ground at this moment in time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and humans are short-lived, as they, you know, compared to the world itself. And really anything worth doing is going to be there's things worth doing that aren't multi-generational, but we need to be thinking one generation into the next. Instead, we're filling hazardous waste landfills. I'm planning a trip back to the Love Canal hazardous waste landfill and neighborhood, which is a monument to not thinking about the future. That's our current definition of multi-generational. What we're saddling our great grandchildren with is horrifying to think of, and I wish we had a little more foresight than that.
I think the fetishization of I don't actually know what your position is on this, but the fetishization of nuclear is exhibit A when it comes to historical myopia, where the gains that can be acquired from the implementation of nuclear power might last a century at most, if I'm being unfairly generous, and the liabilities will span thousands of years.
Yeah.
Whether you're talking about the potential for immediate catastrophic disaster or just the consequence of the enormous waste output, the radioactive toxic excrescence of nuclear power, right? Yep. And so there's what you meet there is the intersection of both this incredible short-sightedness, but also the hubris of technology and science, which has been in the background of our conversation. This mm-hmm. Promethean, the conceit, it comes back to this conceit. It's just an example.
Yeah. Well, and there's a wonderful book by Kurt Vonnegut that even if you're a slow reader like me, will only take you a day or two to read, called Cat's Cradle. And it sums all of this up in a scathing, hilarious satire. It's where the term Ice Nine comes from. We've all heard of Ice Nine. Ice Nine is a substance that can convert water to a crystalline substance at any temperature. So it'll convert the ocean to ice at ambient temperatures. And driving the whole background of the book is a couple of vials of this, three little vials of this substance called Ice Nine, that this retired nuclear scientist who was a chemistry tinkerer. So he had a chemistry lab in his basement. And as a retired guy, he comes up with this substance. When he dies, his three children inherit it. So it's a disaster waiting to happen. And it's a Vonnegut got the idea working as a spokesman for PR guy for GE. So he was in momentarily, he was in the belly of the beast. And a previous generation of GE PR guys, one of them made the concept up for a visit to GE by H.G. Wells and said, "Hey, I've got this idea for you." H.G. Wells was not interested. It wound up in the file cabinet of the GE PR department, I believe in Schenectady. Vonnegut enters that department. He reads the files. He finds it. And it becomes this incredible symbol for dioxin. Let's talk about climate change. For all the irreversible things that we are doing, and I worry much less about the Earth than I worry about our ability to be sustained by the planet that we live on. The Earth has been through the greater heavy bombardment. There's been ice age after ice age. The Earth will be fine eventually. It's all relatively small on the scale of the Earth, and life will evolve around whatever the effects of what we do may be in a million years.
So,
but we're messing with our relationship to live on the planet. It's not about the planet. It's about us. It's about our kids. It's about their kids.
And sort of, you know more about this than I do, but just as long as we're on this, as long as we're iterating examples of short-sightedness, the projects of geoengineering and atmospheric engineering that are at hand, and people think that that's all tinfoil cap stuff, but there are people actively engaged in these, and I'm just like gobsmacked at what propositions are on the table that are being seriously countenanced, like dimming the Earth and things like this.
Yep.
And it's just the challenge is trying to enter into meaningful conversation with people who would be supportive of these kind of agendas. They've been so captured by this narrative of catastrophism that they are prone to entertain projects that are just, it's beyond, they're reckless and hazardous in a way that it's like, why are we even having this conversation? Is it not transparent to you? Is it not transparent to you that what you are doing is going to elicit incredibly negative consequences?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And here we get into a kind of a core issue of human beings' relationship to their own existence. Really, I mean, how we deal with the matter of death, how we deal with the passage of time, how we think about the consequences of any action at all, great or small, who we expect to take responsibility for our actions in the future, that we've committed today. You know, there's a lot that should be coming to a head right now.
So, drawing the circle back to the digital, here's a question for you that was inspired by your remark there, right?
And let's wrap up there.
Does the digital give us a false sense of immortality that is interfering with entering into a more meaningful relationship with death and life?
Yeah.
And if so, then how do we get beyond that particular illusion or impression?
I don't know how we get beyond it. I think that these digital tools are incredibly ego-aggrandizing, and they are detached from reality and detaching from reality. And I would like to wrap up here. When I work with the people of East Palestine, you know, I broke the dioxin story. One place had reported it, but it was getting no traction. And I was able to punt that out onto the public, out into the public dialogue in a pretty big way, because I've done the story 100 times. And when I got to the point where I had to actually work with the people of East Palestine, I was seriously depressed by the idea of how it was they could ever possibly organize themselves in the digital world. The homeowners at Love Canal were able to organize. They had meetings. They formed groups. They had a headquarters in the development. They were able to invite officials of the EPA in and not let them leave until the president declared a disaster area. None of that is feasible or even envisionable under digital conditions. And I can tell you my remedies. I make every effort to meet the people that I work with, to meet the people that I serve. So I'll take any opportunity to meet with a reader. I was recently in Thailand and got to meet a diversity of fellow presenters, some of whom I think are great, some of whom I think are not so great. But I spent time with them day after day. I try to convey a very strong sense of place in the work that I do, so that I'm not in the everywhere is nowhere factor of the internet. As you are doing, broadcasting from a local coffee house. And I think we just really have to live the day and, you know, reclaim our humanity. And to me, that means I meet every dog that crosses my path. Literally every dog, unless there's something that prevents me from getting across the street. And so I meet every dog that crosses my path, and then I meet the people whose dog it is, and I've had countless thousands of human encounters around the world because I meet every dog. And so there's things we can do to keep us grounded in our humanity. The internet is making us mean, and I think that kindness becomes revolutionary in the midst of this nasty meanness. I paid you $8. I'm entitled. It's like, come on, it's midnight and I'm answering your email, and I'm this writer you say you love. Why don't you say hello? It's actually me. You can even call me up right now if you want. So we need to, little things like that, we need to mind our manners. and if you see somebody sitting on a bench near your house and they're looking forlorn, stop and ask them if there's any way you can help them. Really, I mean, otherwise we're going to wind up in a Clockwork Orange.
That sums it all right. You know, up there. Get into
Thomas,
your
I'm pressed for time.
That will wrap it up.
I want to thank you for this interesting, unique, and fun discussion. I think we see things in a similar way, but have very different approaches to it. So that's really going to be interesting radio. So thank you for a lot of good laughs, and tap me again should you need me or want to share resources in some way.
Absolutely, two-way street. Thank you so much, Eric.
Thomas.
And I'll go ahead and end the recording here.
My pleasure. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.